I feel like I'm missing out because it seems like everyone is either starting a side hustle or becoming their own boss. And you know what these people are hearing a lot? Cha-ching! It's the sound of another new sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform that helps you to start up, run, and grow your own business. Shopify is the commerce platform that's revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're selling stuff that you design and create yourself in the home and garden, fashion, or health and beauty industries, or perhaps it's something that you're upcycling to give it a whole new look and use for sale, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can successfully grow your business. Covering all of your sales channels, from its all-in-one e-commerce platform to a shopfront-ready point-of-sale system, Shopify can even get you selling across lucrative social media marketplaces such as Instagram, TikTok, or Facebook. Because it's full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite growth, Shopify gives you complete control over your business and your brand, so you don't need to learn any new coding or design skills. And thanks to award-winning help and with an extensive business course library, Shopify is ready to support your success every step of the way. Now, what's lovely about Shopify is that no matter how big you want your business to grow, Shopify is there at every stage to empower you with the confidence and control to take your business up to that next level. It's time to get serious about selling and get Shopify today. What are you waiting for? This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/enthusiast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.co.uk/enthusiast to take your business to the next level today. shopify.co.uk/enthusiast. Hello all, and the very warmest of welcomes to a brand new series of the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, where I have changed absolutely nothing about it throughout the break. If it isn't broken, then don't mess with it is a maxim I firmly believe in. And where as ever, I continue to strive to seek out those tales of true crime from the darkest depths of the UK and Ireland that aren't ten a penny on other shows, that you may not often believe or have ever heard of, but which are all as true as the day you were born. Still doing so is myself, Paul, the creator, host and true crime enthusiast of the show's title, the most popular member of Team Enthusiast, my feline cineman, Peeksy, the true crime enthusiast cat, is with me as ever, though he is fast asleep right now, for a change. And we are completed by yourselves, the wonderful enthusiasts whose support and enthusiasm for the show have brought it to this point, series number 9, which is absolutely mind-bending. I can't even begin to tell you. And doing the show by now is like wearing a favourite pair of shoes. My passion for doing it is unquenched and it just grows. It's stronger than ever. It is as wonderful as always having you joining me in the Mog today. I thank you so kindly for doing so, and I hope that as you join us, it's for an episode that finds you and yours all good, all safe, and all well. So, I start the new series with an epic tale. It is one that's caused me a few headaches whilst researching, which I shall explain about as the episode goes on and more in the concluding part. For, oh yes, we start the series with a two-part tale. Such a fascinating and disturbing story it is that I couldn't scrimp upon it at all. And so if the episode seems a tad shorter than usual and you think you aren't getting enough bang for your buck, it's a two-parter and it's structured to allow this, but I shall begin it shortly. Before that, a massive thanks must go out to both my new and returning Patreon supporters, and as I haven't name-checked in a long time, I'm proper playing catch-up here, so bear with me. Shout-outs go out to Graham Large, Hazel Hawcutt, Esme Chin Yet, Caroline Topping, Pam H, Brandy Shamowski, He's Too Good, Michaela Long, Angela Stone, Colleen Corrigan, Kurt Burkett, Michael Webb, Stephen Wright, Ann Kelly, Molly Miller, Neil and Ben, the Gas Men, great name, Lisa Farrell, Maz from Oz, Gary Soden, Vicky Brindley, Kathy Watson, Brenda White Brockway, Margaret Lloyd, Charlene Thompson, Whitney B, EJ, Lorraine Moore, Susan Hislop, plus Linda Nelson, Scared of Goats. That's two separate supporters, that is, by the way, not me making a statement about Linda. Sarah Journeau, Mark Francis, Shona Peterson, Tracy Newman, Michelle Graft, Neem Buckley, Miss I. Barham, She Brooks, Pam Canbaz, Dre, Deborah, Miss I. Barham, and Ruth Hayes, who have each kindly opted to annually support the show. And I'm so sorry if I've even mispronounced anybody's name and that it's taken me so long to broadcast my thanks, which are heartfelt too. You folks are wonderful. Thank you so much for your kind support. Now, if like the aforementioned, you want yourself some extra enthusiast in your life, then I bring out a monthly bonus episode exclusive for Patreon supporters that you'll get sometimes a while before it ever features on the regular show. Sometimes they're just for you, and a right mixed bag of tales there are available in there as well. From the sheer horror and sadness of tales such as Wicked Beyond Belief, An Offering to the Angels, or Status, to the light-heartedness of tales such as Are You Sure You're Legal? And The Master Criminals, or the plain bizarre of The Strange Tale of Hellish Nell, there are more than 50 unreleased bonus tales there now, and there is something there to cater for all, with a new one being added each month. Details can be found by seeking out the show on Patreon. Don't forget the podcast suffix while you do so, or scratch even doing that, because there's a link in each and every episode show notes that will take you right to it. And you can be hearing these tales and more quicker than I turned off the Brit Awards this year. I have never wished for an earthquake to happen more, I tell you. What an absolute shower of shit. And it's so simple to do. Diane Abbott could smash it. Well, maybe. And now, enough of that. Back in the room, professional head on, for I have a series to begin. The tale I've opted to come back with to begin Series 9 is one I've always had in mind since I began The Enthusiast. In fact, the first thing that went through my mind when I've come to properly put it together is, why have I not gotten around to this one until now? And it is truly a unique story, one that there's so much to, only a two-parter would do it justice, I felt. The tale involves an individual whose behaviour was as bizarre as his crimes were horrific, as you'll come to hear, and who 40 years ago this year, in a reign of terror spanning almost 5 months, instilled such fear in the public, without any exaggeration, that his hunting grounds in the south of England became known as the Triangle of Terror. His exploits, the hunt for him, and his eventual detection and capture make up one of the most complex, disturbing, chilling, yet fascinating tales I've ever covered on The Enthusiast. And I hope that as you come to hear it, you agree. The episode contains details and descriptions of crimes and events, including descriptions of a sexual nature, that some listeners may find disturbing and/or distressing. So please use discretion whilst you're listening in all. Bearing that in mind, it's a warm welcome back. It is so good to be back with you folks. And please join the True Crime Enthusiast for the first of a two-part tale I've entitled Triangle of Terror for Part 1, Fox Hunt. Covering an area of more than 650 square miles, looking down over the southern English counties of Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. The Chiltern Hills are a chalk escarpment that stretch some 45 miles, from Goring-on-Thames in the southwesterly point to Hitchin in the northeasterly, and that half of which have, for almost 60 years now, been designated an area of outstanding natural beauty. A popular area for outdoor enthusiasts of all pursuits, The hills are filled with several long-distance trails and peaks for people to scale. And one of these is 233 metres above sea level, National Trust-owned and managed Ivinghoe Beacon. Its far-reaching views of scenic countryside, ancient woodlands spread across rolling hills, and wildflower-rich grassland making the hilltop a particularly popular viewpoint. Due to its prominence and natural slope, Ivinghoe Beacon has also been a popular spot for many years for model aircraft enthusiasts because it offers some of the best slope-soaring prospects that there is. I'm not going to try to explain what that is, but in layman's terms, it's chucking a model aircraft off a hill without worrying too much about it breaking because the unpowered aircraft are flown using the lift generated by the wind blowing up the hill. And for those who are just missing that little extra thing in their lives, this practice is ruled with a rod of iron by the Ivinghoe Soaring Association, which I'm sure is as wonderful and rewarding as it sounds. But in the early 1980s, not every model aircraft enthusiast atop Ivinghoe Beacon was there merely to fly their craft. It was a favoured spot of the individual who will become the focus of this episode and the next one, who liked it not just for the enthrall of flying model aircraft there, which he'd been an enthusiast of since his school days, but because it commanded such a far-reaching view of several towns and villages that fell straddling three county boundaries within a triangle pattern, corner-pointed by the Hertfordshire town of Tring and the Bedfordshire towns of Dunstable and Leighton Buzzard. In the space of several months that spanned the hot summer of 1984, the individual would visit this spot several times to fly his planes, but each time also scanning the horizon and making a mental note of the layout of towns and villages that fell within this area. Specifically, selecting the most rural, easily accessible, and escapable ones, that beginning in the late spring of that year, he was to strike terror into through a one-man rampage. But I've opted to time jump here to start, so we first head to the 3rd of March of the following year, 1985, for a lengthy account that was given to the Sunday People newspaper by a then 32-year-old Milton Keynes woman named Hilary Lee, describing the events of September the 8th, 1984. I bring this largely as was recorded back then, and as these are Hillary's own words as she was being interviewed, though interspersed with some artistic license by the newspaper, I believe it's the truest account of what happened. A common theme throughout research in this entire tale has been conflict of details between different sources, and I've done the absolute best I can with it. I will explain at points when we reach said conflicts. Hilary Lee remembers standing in the front room of her home in the village of Bradwell that Saturday night doing the family ironing. At about 8 o'clock that evening, she'd said goodbye to her husband John, who was on night shifts that week working as a processor at the UK offices of Kodak in Hemel Hempstead. And as it got dark, Hilary switched on the light and continued with the ironing. But for once, she'd forgotten to pull the curtains across the long patio door windows. Now, with the light on inside the front room, due to the reflection in the glass, she couldn't see outside. But the man in the mask who was crouching in the garden could see her inside clearly. She finished the ironing, left it in two neat piles ready to be put away the following morning, and then sat down on the settee to watch the evening news. Following this, Hilary switched off the light and went upstairs, checked on her two children, then 2-year-old James and 5-year-old Kira, who were both sleeping soundly, and then got into bed herself. For a short while, she read Elvis Presley's biography, and remembered hearing the distant sound of music coming from someone's party in a neighbouring house as she drifted off to sleep at about 11 o'clock. What happened next engraved those ordinary details of an ordinary Saturday evening on Hilary's mind forever. For in the early hours of that Sunday morning, she was awoken. she recalled. I felt a tap on my shoulder and thought it was my little girl. I opened my eyes, looked up, and saw this dark figure wearing a dark mask. I could only see his eyes. One of the piles of ironing was lying on the floor beside the bed, and on top was a long piece of washing line from the garden. I didn't realise it then, because I didn't know this figure was the fox, but I thought he was planning to strangle me with my own washing line, and the ironing he'd brought upstairs was for binding and gagging me, and God knows what. Now at this point of the interview, the newspaper reports that Hillary lit what seemed like her umpteenth cigarette, for since that night the previous September, she was smoking up to 30 cigarettes a day and drinking coffee like it was going out of fashion. She continued, "He was pointing my own bread knife at me, and at first I was confused. Half asleep, I could still hear the music coming from the party, and it flashed across my mind that he was something to do with that. I got out of bed, without thinking, and told him to take what he wanted and go. In fact, I told him to fuck off, and that's not a word I often use." But Hillary's crudely masked visitor, I'll explain what I mean by crudely shortly, just stared at her silently for a moment, and then said, in a very quiet, calm, but firm voice, "Get on the bed and don't wake the bairns." Hillary laughed nervously as she recalled in the interview. "I remember thinking, what an extraordinary thing to say. You don't expect a maniac to be worried about waking the children, but he was, he really was. I refused, for I knew if I got on the bed, he'd rape me. I didn't make any decisions to be brave or anything like that. I just acted automatically." The masked man repeated his order, but Hillary continued to refuse, and she continued in the interview. "Then he came at me. He cornered me between the bed and the wall. He kept saying, 'I'll stab you, I'll stab you.' I had my hand on his arm trying to push him away, and I remember thinking how taut his arm muscles were when I was fighting him off. He had the body of a very fit man. I felt him pressing up against me, and then felt the knife go across my stomach. Suddenly, there was blood everywhere. And then, at the same time, I could hear James shouting, 'Mummy! Mummy!' That seemed to panic him, the sound of James shouting, for he made for the door and closed it behind him. God knows why, but I started running after him. I followed him down the stairs and got into the front room just in time to see him escape through the patio doors and then the garden. I could hear James crying, so I started mopping up the blood on the carpet, then rushed upstairs and put on my dressing gown so he wouldn't see the blood, and went and got him out of his cot and came downstairs again. All sorts of crazy things were going through my mind. I remember being furious that someone had gotten into the house after we'd just spent all that money on double glazing. I could still hear the pop music coming from that party. It was so unreal, I thought. How could that party be going on at the same time it was all happening to me? I suppose I should have rung the police first, but all I could think about was ringing John." John Lee recalled the terrifying phone call that he received from his wife in the early hours, saying, "I knew it was bad news, her ringing at that time of night. I thought it was a fire or something. When she told me she'd been stabbed, I put the phone down and rang police before heading home. Then I realised I hadn't asked Hillary about the kids, so all the way home, I was desperately worried if they were all right." Back at the Lee's small end of terrace three-bedroomed home, the place was soon surrounded by armies of police officers, dog handlers and helicopters, and after receiving medical attention, and thankfully the wound Hillary had received was not too serious, she was beginning to tell a terrifying story for the first time, prompted by the police into remembering every tiny detail. It was a story she told over and over again until 2:30 the following Sunday afternoon. And so by the time she spoke to the Sunday People newspaper in March 1985, following the trial and conviction of the individual responsible, Hillary remembered every detail without even trying. The article reported she sounded, I quote, "slightly mechanically cool, as though something about the way she's learned to tell the facts of the story helps her to block out the pain it's caused her." Though it does also report that she did display some real hints of the pain and trauma that the event had left her with, demonstrated in the nervous little laughs and awkward jokes that crop up all the time throughout the interview. For example, she made a joke about the Marks and Spencer nightdress she was wearing on the night in question, saying, with mock disappointment, "I couldn't say it was one of those glamorous numbers." The night he ended up covered in blood and was taken away by police for forensic examination, which it was stated that Hillary wouldn't be asking for back, the same as her own bread knife which had been used to injure her, with her explaining, "The last time I used that knife was for making the kids tea on the Friday. I didn't actually use it on the Saturday, because I always buy soft rolls on Saturday, you see." And again, this was followed by a nervous laugh. Now, Hillary was to be the final victim of the individual who came to be known as the Fox. For just 3 days after his attack on Hillary, he was captured, and reportedly, it took detectives a long time to get him to admit to Hillary's assault. Hillary continued, "I suppose it's because it was a case of failure for him. At the time, it never occurred to me that he was the Fox, although I'd of course heard of him. It was only when police were questioning me that I realised it was the Fox who had entered my bedroom. It's every woman's nightmare, of course, to wake up and find a man threatening to rape her. And really, I think it was James who saved me. God knows why he woke up that night. He never normally does, and I hadn't made a lot of noise, but I'm sure he saved my life. I'm sure that's what scared off the Fox." Hillary then stared down at the picture on the front page of the Daily Mirror newspaper underneath the coffee table and gave a little shudder as the unmasked face of the Fox stared back at her, reportedly the first time she had seen his face. She continued, "I can't decide if he's uglier in the mask or out of it. I didn't imagine his face like that. He's much uglier somehow, for I always thought he'd have kind of a baby face." Now, at the time of this interview, Hillary and her family had moved out of the house that she had rapidly grown to hate, with her explaining, "We were going to move anyway, but after this, I just didn't want to stay in the house." After Christmas, the depression about everything that had happened really hit me. I started to think that everyone around me was going to die. I had to get tablets from the doctor. "But now, I've decided I'm not going to give that man the satisfaction of changing my life. I'm going to try and put it all behind me." The article concludes by saying how, though, in a million little ways, everything had changed for Hillary. She smoked more, she drank endless cups of coffee, she never again forgot to draw the curtains in the front room, and she still couldn't face hanging out the washing on the line in the back garden. Whether that's the terror of someone being there watching as she did so, or the fear of seeing the line itself after thinking it was going to be used to strangle her, who knows? Now, the account described here sounds terrifying beyond imagination, I'm sure you'll agree. And you can only hope that over time, Hillary did manage to put such an ordeal behind her. But who knows how long something like that would take, though. It was, as I said, the final attack by an individual who by then was Britain's most wanted man, who had struck terror into the hearts of householders of three counties through his horrific, disturbing actions, causing near hysteria, and who had come to be known by the public and the 200-plus strong team of police who were hunting him in one of the biggest manhunts since the search for the Yorkshire Ripper, as the Fox. Though by no means, sadly and horrifically, was it the worst offence that he was responsible for. Beginning from October 1983, the triangle I mentioned before came to be peppered with a spate of break-ins of residential properties spanning across it that, as they increased in number, a recognisable pattern in them began to form. Favouring single-storey properties, ideally those backing onto fields or woods, the intruder would swiftly and silently make his way into the premises, usually by forcing a window with a chisel or a screwdriver. Once inside, he showed no signs of panic or being anxious to grab whatever he could and go before being discovered, like most burglars. This one instead taking time to rifle the property and taking from the scene not just the obvious ready loot of cash or jewellery, but all manner of items also, from electrical goods to toys, videotapes, vintage magazines, and even musical instruments as well. Sometimes he would forgo all of this and take merely food and drink from the scenes. Because the offences took place scattered over three counties, there was no single team at first hunting for the intruder. But as 1983 turned into 1984, there was a bit more of a worrying, unsettling development that meant that, pretty soon, there was to be. If you've ever had the misfortune of being burgled, and I have myself many years ago, then you'll know it is a horrible feeling to know that a stranger has been in the sanctuary of your home. It's unsettling, and I can really understand people who feel they need to move house after such an event. I'm talking here about someone being just in and out quickly, grabbing whatever they can. But how about an intruder who feels totally comfortable being in a house? So much so that whilst rifling through your belongings looking for things to steal, he stops when he finds a family photo album and takes time out to look through it. That adds another slight level of chill in that, doesn't it? From March 1984, several homeowners in these areas, the exact amount is unknown, but it is at least a dozen, who either woke up or came home to find an intruder had been in their homes, discovered just this. And in some cases, the intruder had removed several photographs from the album and placed them neatly in a pattern on the floor. And on occasion, had even taken some of the photos away as part of his haul. Usually, family holiday snaps depicting women in bikinis. That would just make you shudder that much more, wouldn't it? And then, on Wednesday the 11th of April 1984, the intruder's spree took yet another sinister, disturbing turn. As was described to a court the following year, that evening, a 74-year-old widow who lived alone, named by one source as a Mrs. Ryder, had at about 9 p.m. turned off the lights in her home in the town of Linslade near Leighton Buzzard and had headed up to bed. For almost an hour, she'd read peacefully and then turned out the light. She was just drifting into sleep when she was startled awake by a strange shuffling sound, and when she opened her eyes, saw a dark-clad figure stood at the bottom of her bed. John Alliott, KC, prosecuting, told the court. The occupant heard a slight shuffling sound and woke to find the man who was the defendant in the doorway of the bedroom. He was not wearing any form of mask or disguise, but held a gloved hand over his face to prevent any recognition. He went to the bed and pulled back the bed covers to reveal she was wearing a full-length nightdress. The defendant then put his hand inside her nightdress and indecently assaulted her twice, despite her struggling, but when he went to a third time, she resisted and he fled. Terrified, when she was sure the intruder had gone, Mrs. Ryder made her way downstairs and telephoned police, who were around very shortly. It isn't reported as to whether any property or monies were missing from her home. But scenes of crime officers were able to, using a fast-setting plastic called Silverset, make a perfect impression of the tool that the intruder had used to force entry to the house via a downstairs window. An 8mm flat-bladed screwdriver with distinctive markings on its head. Another valuable clue was discovered from an examination of the victim's nightdress, for it yielded several fibres. Invisible to the naked eye, that were ultimately identified as being rabbit fur. Traces from the inner lining of the gloves that the intruder had worn during the attack. Now, if this was the same strange offender that had already undertaken a prolific burglary spree, then it was an alarming development in his criminality. It is incredibly rare for an individual to force his way into the home of someone with the intention of sexual assault. And, with almost echoes to another terrifying individual we've met a few years ago now, here on the show, Peter Cook, the Cambridge rapist, it seemed that this was a case of opportunism. To quote Cook's own words, "I came to rob, but I think I'll rape you instead." Detective Chief Superintendent Brian Prickett, the officer who came to lead the hunt for the fox, said the following year, "That was something he'd never done before in all of his life of crime as a burglar, and he couldn't get the thought out of his mind. After that, he seemed obsessed with the idea of tying up a woman and raping her." As you'll see from the next reported attack, and I say reported because there is always the chance that burglaries occurred that weren't attributed to him, which is very likely, or even assaults that went unreported, a bit less likely. But the fox wasn't as specific as was just described. It's now Thursday the 10th of May, and 6.5 miles from Linslade in the Buckinghamshire village of Cheddington. Then 35-year-old farm labourer Harry MacDonald, as one source names him, had been out for the evening visiting his girlfriend. Making his way home at about 11 p.m, Harry entered his dark and detached house, and before he had a chance to turn on the light, he was blinded by the light of a torch shining upon him, coming from the direction of his sofa. Managing to turn the lights on, Harry was shocked to see a figure wearing dark clothing and wearing a crudely made mask with iron mouth holes cut into it that had been knotted at the top. Harry was later to describe it as seeming to have been made from the material of overalls, as though a leg had been cut off and knotted to make it. Saw the figure sat on the sofa, pointing his own single-barreled 12-bore shotgun at him, which had been removed from a cupboard under the stairs. As he put up his hands to show that he offered no resistance to the intruder, taking stock of the scene, Harry was to notice what would become another calling card of the individual, for laid out on the coffee table were a selection of ties, laces, belts and scarves, anything that could be used to restrain an individual. Whereas most burglars would have been satisfied with stealing their loot undetected and unchallenged, not this one, for instead, after pocketing some £300 and removing the shotgun and cartridges, he had decided to wait and see who would turn up. A court heard the following year. The Crown takes the view he was intending to rape any female that may have been returning. Harry was then bound and gagged using the items described, and once he was secured, rather than ransack the house further, the intruder then calmly put on some pornographic videos that he'd found. Yes, pre-internet, these were the days when people still had pornos stashed away. And forced Harry to watch them with him, before eventually, he forced Harry upstairs to his bedroom at gunpoint. Here, the intruder made a crude and clumsy attempt to bugger Harry, before he abandoned this, and indecently assaulted his victim, forcing the helpless man to perform oral sex upon him. He then fled, taking the shotgun and several rounds of ammunition and leaving the distraught man tied up. Detective Superintendent Prickett explained later how this attack was some sort of experiment, saying, "He had never before had a homosexual experience. There he was, inside the house, armed with a gun and expecting a woman. The man walked in, so he decided to try and rape him, just as he'd seen in the videos he was obsessed with." It's quite disturbing, that, isn't it? Now, following another three burglaries around the Buckinghamshire village of Edlesborough, three that he was later to admit to anyway, and somewhere where he was to return only a few weeks later with horrific consequences, on Wednesday the 6th of June, Mr. Sinister, as the intruder had first become known, now broke into the home of a couple in Grove Park in the Hertfordshire town of Tring. Now, incidentally, it's at this point of the tale that information begins conflicting between sources, and there are points of ambiguity, and this is a prime example. For although the date of this is consistent, the events that occurred do differ slightly, as do the names of the owners of the property, for sources describe them variously as Jeff and Pamela Penfold and Tom and Barbara Yates, so I'll just refer to them as the owners. Through researching, what can be put together is that when the intruder broke into the property, he found an empty house, as the couple were out for the evening. After removing the bulbs from the interior lights, while searching the house, he found another shotgun and cartridges. Reportedly, he had buried the one he'd stolen from Harry MacDonald, a 12-bore single-barrel shotgun, serial number 121823, so well for safekeeping that he was unable to find it again, as well as finding a hacksaw which he used to saw off the barrels of the shotgun, a 50-year-old hammer-action Belgian-made 12-bore double-barreled weapon he would take with him and use for almost the remainder of his crimes. He then repeated this behaviour of leafing through, removing photographs from family albums and arranging them in a pattern on the floor, and also went around taking clothing from drawers, ties, belts, even a roll of sellotape, anything that could be used to tie someone up, and laying them neatly out on the coffee table, and had then settled down to await the occupants returning home, turning on the television. He even had the gall to open a packet of peanuts to eat, spilling several as he did so, and making himself a pot of tea. However, as time passed with no sign of the occupants returning home, the intruder became increasingly restless and eventually left the property, taking with him the shotgun and cartridges, £125 in cash that he'd found, and bizarrely, the bag of peanuts and a blue anorak belonging to the owner. The owners, luckily, returned home not too long afterwards to find the back door now unlocked, after they'd left it secured, the lights in the hallway not working, and when they managed to get a standard lamp working, the living room left laid out as described and the television still on. They even found peanuts scattered over the floor, a cup with the remains of tea still in it, and the teapot still warm. Following another break-in the following night in the same town, this time in Chilton Way, and where only food was stolen, there comes now another point that there's some ambiguity with also, because the events I'm about to describe are claimed equally between sources as occurring on the 6th of June in the property I've just described, and the 9th of June, and again, Tom and Barbara Yates are named as being the homeowners. Because of the events I'm about to describe, I'm more inclined to believe that this occurred on the 9th, the night that Mr. Sinister became known as the Fox. Late on Saturday the 9th of June, he broke into a house in the village of Heath and Reach, 2 miles north of Leighton Buzzard, a house that backed onto open land and where the owners were again out for the evening. He removed the light bulbs to ensure darkness, and then again went through what had almost become a bizarre ritual for him. Before settling down to await them coming home, he went around and collected dressing gown cords, ties, belts, sellotape, then cut the telephone wires to the property, went out into the garden and made an escape route for himself, and then helped himself to some food from the fridge, eating a salad and making another pot of tea. But this time, he added a further strange dimension to his MO. Before he turned on the television, the intruder moved furniture in the living room about so that two chairs were about 6 feet apart either side of the television, and he then covered these and the television with a bedspread and blankets from the owner's bed, his aim being to use this strange hide to be able to watch videos without the risk of being spotted by passers-by from the giveaway light from the television. By the time the occupants had returned home, at about 1:30 a.m. the following morning, the fox, as he was known going forth, following discovery of this makeshift hide, and how we shall now refer to him, had left the scene, leaving them to discover this bizarre and disturbing sounding setup. And thinking about it, as I said earlier, as well as the unsavoury thought someone's been in your home and made themselves comfortable, the bizarreness of finding such a scene as described as well would unsettle and frighten you more, wouldn't it? But the fox wasn't done for the evening. After leaving this property, meanwhile, he'd crossed fields on foot to another house in Leighton Buzzard. The occupants here, a married couple, Bernard and Linda Jackson, were fast asleep when, 2 hours after his aborted attack, the fox entered their home and made his way upstairs. Being a light sleeper, Bernard had awoken at the sound of the bedroom door being pushed open, and in the pale glow of a nightlight, saw the wiry-looking figure who had appeared in their bedroom doorway, brandishing a shotgun and wearing his homemade mask. It must have been a terrifying sight for the couple that day. Bernard shouted at the intruder, I'm sure you can imagine, and instinctively drew the duvet around him with one hand whilst automatically raising the other to shield himself and Linda from harm. Now, whether by design or accident, and the fox was to claim to police later that it was purely by the latter due to his lack of experience with firearms, the gun went off and Bernard was hit in the hand. Fortunately, the duvet he had wrapped around had taken the majority of the remaining pellets, the others blowing a hole in the bed and only narrowly missing Linda. Despite a nasty injury, Bernard chased the fox from the house, watching him flee through the kitchen window that he'd forced open and away through the back garden, before collapsing in the kitchen from a combination of shock and blood loss. Despite the best efforts of surgeons, Bernard was to lose a finger as a result of his injury. Meanwhile, so disturbed had the fox been by this aborted attack that the stolen anorak and the bag of peanuts he'd taken from a previous burglary had been left behind. The fox himself would later tell police, following his arrest, that the gun going off scared him so much he committed no further sexual offences for a month. But this attack made real for police their greatest fear, that the gun carried in the attacks wasn't just for show. Choosing his words carefully, Detective Chief Superintendent Brian Prickett told the media, "This man will use his gun and he will kill. If a husband is forced to watch some terrible act being performed on his wife, then I can well understand how difficult it would be to control his emotions, but I can only advise him not to provoke this man into killing." Must be almost an impossible ask that though, isn't it? Though there were no further sexual offences reported, the events of the early hours of the 10th of June didn't make him go to ground for long, for just 4 days after the attack on the Jacksons, the fox broke into a house in Rectory Close in the Buckinghamshire village of Slapton, where he again disturbed family photographs and stole cash. He also reportedly broke into a house in Duke's Ride in Leighton Buzzard on the 6th of July, but it's likely that there were other offences in between these that may have gone unreported or unrecognised as his handiwork, for someone so prolific, bottom line as a housebreaker, a 3.5 week break in offences wouldn't seem likely. But then, also on the 6th of July, he was unable to resist his newfound passion any longer and broke into another house, this time back in Linslade. Once again, it was during the early hours of the morning. Once again, he was armed. And once again, the occupants, a newly married young couple, were in bed asleep. They awoke just before 5 a.m. to find the fox pointing his shotgun at them. He ordered them out of bed and then, with both naked, tied them up with items of their own clothing and shoelaces. He then indecently assaulted the woman, who screamed hysterically as he then tried to pick her up and carry her out of the room, and with this, once again, the fox took to his heels. Just 4 days later, he was at it again though, once again in Linslade, this time in the Bideford Green area, breaking into a bungalow that backed onto Linslade Woods, occupied by a man and wife, then aged 41 and 38, and their two young children, who were all asleep in their beds. After making his way in through the bedroom window where the couple's two children slept, thankfully oblivious, the couple woke to find themselves staring at the now familiar terrifying sight of a masked man wielding a shotgun. He forced the wife to tie up her husband using belts and ties taken from the couple's wardrobe, and he then indecently assaulted her. When her husband protested, he was struck in the face with the butt of the shotgun. The fox then forced the couple to have oral sex with one another, and then raped his wife, as her husband was bound and gagged face down next to her, then tied her up and left through the back door. The couple were eventually freed just before 4 a.m. when they managed to wake the children, who came and untied them. Now, police were almost immediately on the scene, and reportedly believing that the attacker could still be in the vicinity, threw a ring around Linslade Woods. Early that morning, as news of another attack filtered into the local community, residents could hear the sounds of a police helicopter circling the woods, with the repeated orders given by Loudhailer. Give yourself up. Stand up. Put your hands in the air. And give yourself up. Residents living on the outskirts of these woods also saw the alarming sight of several armed police officers hunting this man in a search pattern formation, operating under the command, one whistle, hit the deck, two whistles, we've got him. And yet, this brought nothing. The fox had vanished. Reportedly, as he was himself to tell police later, living up to his wily moniker, the fox lay low in these woods for almost 9 hours before he managed to slip through the police cordon. I say reportedly because, although some sources do claim this, I'm unsure this isn't just sensationalism, for I would have thought myself that he would have been long away by this point, not taking such a chance of capture. I don't know. What I do know is by this time, the strange and savage offender, who struck prolifically and indiscriminately in the towns and villages that the Chiltern Hills overlooked, had brought dread into the hearts of those that lived there. There was a very real climate of fear in the area, and hardware stores that summer of 1984 did a roaring trade. Many people had bought extra locks and chains for their doors and windows. More people bought dogs than ever before, while people kept weapons such as knives or homemade clubs by their bedsides. And perhaps more extreme, gun shops in the area reported a mass increase in sales. In spite of that summer's hot weather, Residents slept with their windows closed and were advised not to leave any downstairs windows open at all during the evening. Some people started using code words as a way of identifying visitors to their property, or developed a system of switching on and off lights as a signal to let neighbours know that they were home safely and were all secure for the evening. Some local residents also went full-on death wish and formed vigilante groups who set up street patrols, with police fearing that these groups may take the law into their own hands should they catch the fox before police officers could apprehend him. Ray Wooten, who was a resident beat officer for the Bideford Green area during the investigation, recalled many years later, "The fear was very real. You could feel the tension. It was immense. People were petrified and didn't feel safe in their own homes. Being visible in their streets was vital for reassurance. The community were pleased to see me on patrol, either on foot or on my bike, acting as a deterrent and giving advice on security measures. It was a very terrifying time, and the community breathed a huge sigh of relief when the arrest was made." So, what did police hunting for the fox know about their quarry? Physically, and you have to bear in mind that any physical description of the rapist was given by people who had suffered humiliating and traumatic assaults by the man, the emotion and terror from which may have clouded their judgment. But the description police had managed to put together was that of a physically fit individual, slim and athletically built, about 5 feet 7 to 5 feet 10 inches tall, 10 to 11 stones in weight, and aged between 20 to 30 years old. Though he was usually masked, he had been in all of the assaults apart from the April 11th attack in Linslade. He was described as being clean-shaven, having dark, short-cut hair that curled on the top, and spoke with an accent alien to the areas where he struck. It was described as northern, likely that of a Geordie, the accent originating from the northeast of England. Two other crucial points that police had by then established were that, firstly, the fox wasn't some rough sleeper surviving by breaking into houses, which would explain the food and drink taken, because several of those who had come into contact with him described him as smelling fresh, as though he had somewhere he could wash and shave, suggesting that he lived somewhere. Secondly, they had also identified him as being predominantly left-handed. He had torn the nightdress off one victim he had attacked by using his left hand, and for any such actions, an individual would surely use their predominant hand. And another victim had described him as wearing a watch on his right wrist, which again is a common sign of a left-hander. In respect to the character traits of the fox, they had established him as a prolific and experienced burglar who was undaunted enough and such of a risk-taker to select multiple homes in the same night, and someone who surveilled the properties he targeted beforehand to ensure easy and risk-free access and egress for him, favouring properties within close proximity to the open countryside, which he would then escape on foot across. With his sexual offending aside, his behaviour once inside a property was very calm and collected, though of course did have these strange aspects about it. The time he spent in the properties, taking time out there to eat and drink, making himself comfortable, settling down to watch television and building hides in the front room, laying out photographs in the way described, and even reportedly, during a number of the home invasions he had committed, wearing anoraks that he found whilst there, but leaving them behind as they were perhaps later found in a separate room. There was also the odd selections of items he would steal, as I detailed earlier, particularly peanuts. He seemed to have a distinct liking for them, so much so that the hunt for him came to be codenamed Operation Peanut. Already a strange enough sounding individual, he'd made the jump from burglar to rapist, however, which as I said earlier is highly unusual in itself, and was evolving as this, as though he was exploring it, experimenting. Furthered by the fact that the Fox had gone from merely obscuring his features by hand to wearing a crude, homemade mask. He had sexually attacked both men and women during his home invasions, and had even forced one victim to watch pornography with him before assaulting him. Very strange and dangerous sounding individual indeed. An operations room for Operation Peanut had been established at Dunstable Police Station, where officers, at the height of the hunt for the Fox, numbering often in their hundreds, paraded on the manhunt on a daily basis. Taking lessons from the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry, the use of a computer utilising an early method of the Holmes system still used today was also employed to log and cross-reference information. It was an unusual occurrence for criminal investigations of the time to use a computer, and which police nicknamed Metal Mickey, named after the eponymous character from an early 1980s TV show involving a family that had a 5-foot-tall robot called this. Now, I barely remember the show myself, though reportedly, when I came to look at it, pop trivia quiz, it was a series produced and directed by Mickey Dolenz, formerly of 1960s band The Monkees. On the ground, there were also police dog units deployed constantly, armed officers out in force, the use of a Lynx helicopter belonging to the British Armed Forces scouring the areas, and at the time, when the United Kingdom was in the midst of the 1984-1985 miners' strike, with police forces contributing manpower to police picket lines, some of these officers were even redirected from these duties to assist in the hunt for the Fox. And even former SAS soldier and tracker Eddie McGee was on standby to help in the hunt, though it isn't reported as to whether he was an investigative tool that was used. Now, we've met Eddie McGee before on the show some years back in the second series episode, Death on Duty, where I recounted his successful role in the search for armed criminal and cop killer Barry Prudhomme in 1982. Another interesting tale that if you haven't heard is one well worth a listen to, and an episode that's still available in the show's back catalogue, Death on Duty. As I said, the hunt for the Fox rapidly became one of the biggest manhunts that the country had, and remains today, has ever seen, which was ultimately to stretch the budgets of Bedfordshire Police to the absolute limits, costing some £200,000 back then in 1984. Police tried every tactic. Known burglars and sex offenders were looked at, as well as serving military personnel in the areas concerned who matched the general description of the Fox. Police presence in the areas the Fox had targeted were increased, as he seemed to favour certain towns and villages and had struck more than once there, and they even appealed to his conscience publicly to give himself up. The officer leading the inquiry, Detective Superintendent Prickett, became a familiar face on television during the hunt. He even appeared on the second ever episode of my beloved Crime Watch UK, BBC You Are Still Twats, in the July 1984 edition, appealing for information, and conscious that the Fox was believed to be from the northeast of England, selected a fellow officer who hailed from the same area to make a public appeal for the Fox to give himself up, hoping he may identify with a fellow Wearsider, and saying that he would meet him anywhere at any time, even if it was in the middle of the night in a darkened field if need be. Detective Superintendent Morris Caro, the aforementioned officer, added in a widely published statement, "I can assure you that you will receive every consideration and have nothing to fear from the police. All we want to do is prevent you from committing murder and other serious offences. I don't honestly believe you are a callous individual, but my one fear is that you may kill someone if you are frightened. That is what we want to prevent." But despite this, and the hunt I've just described, the Fox, undaunted, continued his one-man crime wave unchecked and undetected. Now, following the horrors that you've heard described already, the fox was to go on to commit other burglaries and other sexual crimes. But it was to be his next offence that certainly catapulted him to the status of Britain's most wanted man, though he already unofficially was by that point. It was an offence that sickened and angered the public to the extent that at one point, the incident room that Operation Peanut was being run out of was receiving up to 300 calls a day, with people offering information and suspicion about the identity of the fox. Yet, the focus of the inquiry was soon to head away from the Triangle of Terror and move some 200 miles plus to the north of England, for the fox seemed to be on the move. His next two offences, the reported sexual ones anyway, following the ones I've described here, were to be both his most serious and horrific, but also to prove his undoing and to lead the police to snare him, which I shall tell you all about in the concluding part of Triangle of Terror, as here is a perfect place to end the tale for the time being. I must say that this story does get more horrific, and you will hear some of the most honest, disturbing, yet inspirational words that have aired on the show to date. But it is equally such a fascinating case to have looked at, and I shall be back with the second part very soon, where, as always, I'll save my own full analysis for then. With that, all that remains for me to say is that I've been, I still am, and hopefully still will be Paul, the true crime enthusiast. Wishing you all good and safe times, and I shall speak to you very soon. And once again, it's so good to be back with you folks. Take care all, stay safe, and goodbye for now.